Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of April. Our guest this hour, Professor Tariq Ramadan, is a professor of contemporary Islamic studies at Oxford University. In 2004, the American Embassy called him. He was 9 days away from starting a job at Notre Dame's Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. He had shipped his possessions from Geneva, Switzerland to Indiana, enrolled his children in a school near the new home. The embassy official told him that his visa had been revoked. And a legal battle was launched. Yes, less than a year earlier, the State Department had invited him to speak in Washington, D.C., and introduced him as a moderate Muslim intellectual who denounced terrorism and attacks on civilians. He was now banned from U.S. soil under a provision of the Patriot Act that allows for ideological exclusions. The offense had been to forcefully criticize America's support for Israel and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. accused him of endorsing terrorism through his words and funding it through donations to a Swiss charity with alleged ties to Hamas. Civil liberties groups challenged his case in court for almost 6 years until in late January, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton dropped the allegations against him, effectively ending his ban. And in early April, he made his first appearance in the United States at New York City's Cooper Union, famously known for the Lincoln and Douglas appearance. He participated in a panel discussion about Muslims. He has traveled to other places in the United States to give lectures. He's very, very well known in Europe and draws thousands of people to his speeches. He came to our attention as a possible guest for the program in a special issue of Foreign Policy Magazine, the 100 Top Global Thinkers of 2009. He joins us by phone today from Oxford, where he has just returned following, I guess, a 50-hour journey because of the Iceland volcanic eruption to get back to Britain. He is with us by phone this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. I would imagine there will be many. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our email address, if you'd like to join us that way, is talk@wpr.org. Professor Tariq Ramadan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for your invitation. Thank you so much.
Yes, our great pleasure. Tell me first about your journey back. It took 50 hours?
Yes, it was just crazy. I was in Canada. I was stuck in Canada, so I went from Canada to Morocco, so I stayed 4 hours in Morocco, and then from Morocco to Madrid. This was I was flying with Madrid, and then I took a train from Madrid to Barcelona, a car from Barcelona to Montpellier, a train from Montpellier to Paris, and from Paris to London, another train. So that was just crazy.
Yeah, that was crazy. Now you're home and probably a little bit tired.
It's okay a bit, yes.
But yes. So you made your first public appearance in the United States at Cooper Union in early April of this year. You had been banned from this country for a number of years. Tell me how you were greeted and what your thoughts were about appearing on U.S. soil after this long fight to get here.
Look, to tell you the truth, I was, from the beginning, I was confident. It was very sad for me in 2004 because I lost a job, and I was very happy to come to teach in the U.S. at Notre Dame University. And then this was sad, and my kids and were registered in schools and everything. So the first few months were difficult, and then I was facing something which was quite clearly for me a wrong decision based on a specific administration, because for me I never confused between the people and the specific Bush administration. So I was confident that one day something is going to change in the country, because it was not possible to carry on the way it was. And then seeing the change with the new administration, the way people were talking to me and trying to find a solution, I went back with a very peaceful mind and saying, okay, let us now go beyond the story, because this story now is over. The most important thing for me is what I have been trying to do for the last 25 years is just to be able to say that we are Western Muslims, we are Western at the same time Muslims, and what we want is to contribute to our society in the West, and my experience in Europe, and also because I have been very much involved in everything which has to do with the American situation and in the United States for years. You know, just before being banned, I came in 2 years, or 4 years, I came more than 30 times in the States, and I was in touch with many Muslim communities around the country, but also universities, and trying to do the job. This is what really I was trying to do. So, and I followed what was going on in the States during the last 6 years. So really, for me, it was something which was, okay, let's now start something new and start to work together.
You have written that the fight is not over, that there are numerous foreign scholars who remain banned from the U.S. soil because of the Patriot Act. Has that changed? Have other foreign scholars been allowed in this country since you were allowed?
No, so far we were two, and this was the first positive decision by Hillary Clinton. She, the Obama administration wanted to send a signal, which is good. Now still you have, and this was in the New York Times last week, a few high-profile scholars who are banned from the country, but also so many others who are facing unfair judgments. So I would say that that's a good first step. It's a very important first step. But now what is expected from the Bush administration is to go beyond that and really to be effective in anything which has to do with security, extraordinary rendition, Guantanamo, and preventing scholars from entering the country. This cannot work. This is not the future of your country.
Do you want to respond to these offenses? One had been for you to forcefully criticize America's support for Israel and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the ideological exclusion. The second was you were accused of giving donations to a Swiss charity with alleged ties to Hamas.
Yes, the point is that the charges were about me giving money, but they made a mistake, and they realized the mistake afterward, is that I gave the money between 1998 and 2002, so 1 year before this organization was blacklisted in the States. And up until now, this organization is not blacklisted in Europe where I live. So and then they write and say, you should reasonably have known that this was, an organization connected or allegedly connected to Hamas. I say, I should have known before yourself. So before you blacklisted the organization is just ridiculous. So, but the decision was a retroactive process, is that, they took the decision in the name of security, and even though it would have been impossible for me to know, they still stick to they were, trying just to take this as a pretext. In fact, when I was in the American embassy in Switzerland, I was asked about my position on the war in Iraq, on Palestine, and I said what I have been saying for years now, and I'm repeating this, that I am against killing innocent people. I am against targeting civilians. But the war in Iraq is illegal, and really, if we are serious about the peace process in the Middle East, we really have to look at the Palestinian rights much more than only supporting the successive Israeli governments and prime ministers. So this is where I stood, and this is where I still stand.
Mm-hmm. The president, our president, as you know, gave what many believe to be a very stirring speech in Cairo last June, promising a new relationship with the Islamic world. Has he delivered?
First, we have to say that this speech was very good. And it was very good for many reasons and at many levels. I think it was not only a speech for Muslims around the world and Muslim majority countries. It was also a speech targeting the American audience, saying to the Americans, look, you have fellow Muslim citizens, they are Americans, and they are contributing, and they are an Islamist and American religion. quite important in what he said. Very good speech, very strong words, but still we are waiting, as I said, many, you know, decisions to be implemented, just to show that beyond me and beyond Adam Habib, who also was the other scholar who was then, that's good. But now on security measures, on people who are being jailed without knowing why they are in jail, so up to now, and in the relationship with the Muslim majority countries in the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan, we really now want the second step, which is beyond words, action. We all know we shouldn't be naive. We all know that this is the first term, and when we change, you know, policies and mentalities, it takes time and effort. But still, I think that on that specific field, on this specific issue, it's really important for the American president and his administration to deliver much more than what has been done for the last 2 years.
What would you like to see the U.S. direction be right now in Afghanistan?
I think that, to tell you the truth, I think that there is no way for the American administration to remain there. So I really think that being there and trying to solve the problem, it's as if they lost memory, because you can't change, you know, an administration or even a government or even a policy in Afghanistan the way it's done now, and by, you know, launching a war against the people of the country. It's and supporting, by the way, we have to be to just to face it as it is. You know, the current government is a corrupt government. We all know this. It's all known that. So what we were told is that we are supporting it because we have no other option. And I would say, yes, there are other options, which is just try to deal with the people, to try to find something which was at the beginning of what the President Barack Obama was saying, that it's to deal with multilateralism and, you know, international forces. So the future is not only for the Americans to be there and to ask people to send more soldiers. It's really to come to an agreement with the United Nations, for example, or other countries, to find an international force and to leave, and to try to find a way to leave, and not to be obsessed with geostrategic interests as for oil, gas, and what is going on in Asia. It's not going to be. It's a lost battle. It's already a lost battle. I think that this is what the people are saying when they are on the ground. The specialists are telling you, we are not finding our way. So this has to be heard.
So you would advocate a withdrawal on the part of American forces, NATO forces?
NATO, I don't know. I think that it could be a first step, but I really think that we can find a way of international force and international agreement with many countries sending soldiers and trying to leave the country over the next 2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm interested because you've been called a rock star in Europe. You draw thousands of people to your speeches, to your addresses. I'm wondering about the differences that you were noticing between Muslim integration into an American system of government versus integration or lack thereof in places like France, in places like England, where it seems to me as though the Muslim community is facing a whole host of different kinds of problems. Can you compare and contrast?
Yes, I can. I don't like really this, you know, comparison with a rock star, because people are coming. You know, when I was in the States last week, it's exactly the same. I think it has nothing to do with people, you know, idealizing, that the people are sharing a view, and this is exactly what we are saying, is that lots of people are coming. And in fact, exactly the same in Canada, where, you know, we have thousands coming, or even in the States, when I was in Chicago. Why is it so? Why is it that the people are coming, and the American or the Canadian or the European Muslims are coming? Is that really because we are promoting a vision for us to be completely and fully Western and Muslims at the same time, and say, okay, it's working, far from the controversial debates at the national level. If you come at the grassroots level and at the local level, you will find that things are moving. So, for example, in France, now we are talking about the burqa, you know, the niqab, the veil covering the face, and say we have to ban this 10 years after, or 6 years having banned the headscarves in school. And the point is, it's as if, you know, with Muslims we have a problem in France. Yes, the national rhetoric and the political discussions at the national level are showing that there is a problem. But this, in fact, is not really a problem with Islam. It's a very long story of problems between, you know, the state and church in France, and also the very old and difficult relationship between France and Algeria and colonization. But if you come at the grassroots level, you have now a second, third, and even onward generations. They are integrated. They are they abide by the law. They speak French, and they forgot even Arabic, the Arabic languages and other languages in Turkish or Pakistani for some of them. And then they are involved. What they are facing now has much more to do with socioeconomic problems than with Islam and religion. So what I'm saying is that we have to go now into something which is, when it comes to religion, we are in a post-integration situation where we the cultural and the religious integration is done. But the problem is that we have politicians, they don't come with social policies. They are very fast to culturalize or to Islamize the socioeconomic problems. It's exactly the same that we have, for example, in the UK after 7/7, when we had a discussion about Britishness, who are we, and then you come say the problem is not religious, because the great majority, and there is a consensus condemning what is happening. It's really about the sense of belonging, because Mohammed Siddiq Khan, who was targeting and he was involved in the bombing, was saying, you are killing us in Iraq, we are going to kill you here. And by using this us versus them, he's just saying he has been born in the UK, raised there, but he doesn't have this, or he didn't have the sense of belonging. So we have to work on the sense of belonging, which is a narrative where we stop talking about integration. You know, I'm used to repeat that the success of integration is to stop talking about integration. The more you talk, the more you are telling me that I'm outside the realm of this us. So this is the new we that I'm talking about. And when you come to the United States of America and you listen to what the African American are saying, the African-American Muslims are saying in the inner cities, for example, they say, we are citizens, we are American citizens. Our problem is not that we are Muslim. The problem is that when you are a black American citizen, poor, living in the inner cities, you are facing social discrimination and discrimination on the job market. Let us face it the way it is. Let us come to class segregation and not only about religions as if Islam is a problem. Mm. On that side, Islam is not.
Somebody has said that you speak, what you have to say speaks more to minorities in the United States than to Muslims, speaks more to African Americans and to Hispanics. Do you agree with that?
No, because I think that, you know, it's exactly the opposite. I have lots of, you know, Muslims or Muslim Americans that are coming to my talks, and I'm challenging them by saying, why is it that you immigrants and coming to this country, you are not in touch with, you know, African Americans? There is a gap. Why is it that there is this gap? Why? What is the problem? The problem is classes. Is that you are rich and more and richer than them, and they are poor, and they are accusing you not knowing the country, that you are coming from abroad, you don't understand. So I think that if you look at the people who are coming, I wouldn't say that this is the right perception. Now what I'm trying to do, and I did this the last time I came to the States before the ban, was really I went to the Chicago Convention, where we had on the same day, the same city, at the same time, two conventions, one for the so-called immigrant Muslims, so the new American citizens, and the African-American with Waris al-Din Muhammad, who now passed away. And I went to both because I really think that the future is to go beyond this. And my position is to stop talking about minority, because if you are an American citizen, you are not a minority. There is no minority citizenship. If you are a citizen, you are at home, and you feel at home, so you need to build a sense of belonging. And a sense of belonging is to be able to say as an American, you and me black or white, rich and poor, Muslims or non-Muslims, Catholics, Protestants or Jews or Buddhists or Hindus, all together, our future is the same. We have a common future. So I'm not at all obsessed with any sense of minority feeling. I'm saying, in fact, exactly the opposite. I say the Muslims should face two things and get rid of two things. First is the victim mentality. We are not victims. We are citizens and we have duties and rights. And the second thing is the minority mindset, which is to put yourself on the margin of the society. No, you are a citizen and you have to deliver. You have to contribute. And your presence should be understood as a gift. So I would say that this is what many, many American Muslims are now doing at many levels. When I was, you know, in the I met with congressmen last week when I was in Washington. I met with Ellison, for example, and others. We have exactly the same vision. This is exactly what we think we should do.
We welcome phone calls for you, and we'll start taking them in just one moment. Our guest this hour just returned from a speaking tour of the United States, and also he spoke in Canada after a six-year ban on his appearing here in the United States due to provisions of the Patriot Act. Professor Tariq Ramadan, he is a professor of contemporary Islamic studies at Oxford University, author of What I Believe, president of the think tank European Muslim Network in Brussels, a EU advisor on religious issues, and representing a new generation of Islamic reformers advocating the exploration and application of Islamic traditions and values in a Western context. He serves in an advisory capacity on religious issues for the European Union. Here's our phone number. He's just returned to Oxford. His speaking engagement took place in April. It's still April, so it took place the last couple of weeks. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Should you care to send us an email, you can do that, and that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls for Professor Tariq Ramadan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we start with Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Another extremely fine guest, quite prominent intellectual. May I ask the guest, would I be naive in thinking that what's going on in the Muslim world at the present time, it's an adaptation to modernity, perhaps not just to the West. It is a bit analogous to what happened in Christendom 400 years ago during the Reformation, where there's an intense internal dialogue as to the nature of religious and secular authority, and that this has been recently hijacked and very obviously by the extreme fundamentalists when they attacked the West. But that's not the major dialogue that's going on in the Muslim world. It's how does one adapt to modernity?
Excellent question.
Citizenship in non-Muslim states. So I'm sorry if this is redundant, but is there an analogy with the Reformation? So thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Yes, I it's a good question. I got it very often. It's just a comparative approach between what happened after the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and the Reformation, and saying this is what is happening, or it could be that we are facing exactly the same tensions now in the Muslim majority country. I think that this is, if we have to be very cautious not to come with comparative approaches when it comes to history and a specific history of civilizations or of the history of a specific civilization. I think that the Islamic civilization and its history is quite different from what was the Christian history and the Western history from within, for example, the Catholicism and the reaction that we got from Protestants. Within the Islamic world, when you have to deal with, for example, the time of, blossoming, you know, scientific contribution to the world and philosophy and all this. This was during a time when religion and politics or religions and sciences were very close. The great philosophers were also jurists in the Islamic tradition. So what we got in the West was this, you know, important separation of power and authority is not exactly the same in the Islamic majority country. Now, no one can deny that in the Islamic majority countries today we are facing tension. But I wouldn't say that is exactly the same as what happened 15 centuries ago in the West. I would say that it has to do with, yes, revivalism, but we had it. And if you look at what is done from within the Sunni and the Shia tradition, you have revivalism movement and reformists that are working. But at the same time, the situation is different for two reasons. The first one is really that in Muslim-majority countries, and especially the Arab countries, we have also to be very cautious not to reduce all the Arab or the Muslim-majority countries to the Arab countries. What we are facing today is a lack of freedom, no possible contribution on the intellectual ground, because it's a very, these are very closed country when it comes to freedom of expression and freedom of contribution and even sciences. I would say it's different in Asia, it's different in Africa, where we also have Muslim majority countries. And then the second thing, which is also important, which is the relationship with the West, because when you are self-critical from within the Muslim majority countries or within the Muslim communities, the perception is for many Muslims, oh, you are supporting them against us or the West against us. So there is a power struggle making it even more difficult when it comes to the critical discussion from within. And we have to take this into account. Now, let me just conclude with this. This very important question is that what we have now in Muslim majority countries is a very important debate between literalist and reformist tradition, and I would say with no hesitation, contrary to what we tend to think because of the media coverage, because of the political landscape, is that the mainstream today is the reformist trend all over the world, in the Western communities or Muslim communities in the West, as well as in Muslim-majority countries. Now, this is happening, and this is there, and it's vivid, it's quite important. And our experience in the West will have a tremendous impact in Muslim-majority countries, a very important impact. And I can see it myself while traveling, talking about some of the issues that we are talking about, for example, like applied ethics in science, in economy, in arts, and all this. This is quite important. And then the second thing, which is also important, is for us to go beyond what is the perception that we may have, and to look deep down in the societies, and we'll see that even in Saudi Arabia today, we have, for example, a very important trend of women advocating their rights, and they are struggling. So I would say that there is something from within which is important. I wouldn't compare it to what happened during the Reformation time, because this is in fact not comparable.
Hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We certainly welcome your phone calls. Let's talk, just a follow-up to that, to the impediments in Western society of being able to be, and I know you're a firm believer in this, both fully Western and fully Muslim.
Yes, the first, you know, it's a two-way process. I would say that Muslims and Muslim scholars and intellectuals, they have to do the job. It's really to look at what is happening in our societies, and that, yes, we have to come back to the scriptural sources and to provide the Muslims with new vision, new answers, because we are facing new challenges. So there is a religious discussion which is quite important. There is something also which is a confusion, and I spoke about this. I started to speak about this. This was more than 20 years ago, when I was saying we have to also to differentiate between religious principles and the cultural belonging. So not to come to our countries and to be now a European or an American or a Canadian by saying, look, I should remain the way we were in the countries of origin. No, you know, there is no religion without culture. There is no culture without religion, but religion is not culture. So this is where, as a Muslim, you can take from the surrounding culture and you have to deal with it. So this is a process of being inclusive, being integrating from the surrounding culture. And this is why I call in the book what I believe. I think that the Muslims need to get the three L's. First, to abide by the law of the country, to get the language of the country, and to be loyal to the country. These three L's are very important. This is the starting point of feeling that you are at home. At the same time, the countries and the Western countries should now also reassess their self-perception. You know, when the Pope Benedict XVI was speaking about, you know, the roots of Europe, I said, my answer was, it may be that Europe needs a dialogue with itself, because to reduce like this the past is something which is problematic. And for example, in our teaching, you know, we need a common history of memories. We really now have to say something about, for example, the Islamic contribution in sciences and in philosophies, that are something which is alien to the West, but part of the West, part of the roots of the West, and also about the contribution of the immigrants. When you speak about, you know, the United States of America today, you need to speak about the contribution of the new immigrants, the new Americans that helped this country to be the way it is. And I would say that this is something that has to be officially taught, because when officially you show respect to my fathers and my mothers, it means that I'm part of the whole, you know, narrative that the country, and this is why the African American Muslims are also right to speak about this, to say, let us be officially integrated in the narrative of the country, and the immigrants, the new immigrants, should also be involved in this. And then things that are very important is to stop talking in such a way about minorities, and to speak about our common future, and to build together a new narrative, which means, in fact, not only to come together against enemies. You know, it's, you know, the way the Bush put it just after September, they say we are Americans and it's us versus them, and the ones who are supporting us are with us and the others are the enemy. This binary vision is very problematic. It's very easy to be united against. What now we need in all our countries is to be united for something, for justice, for peace, for solidarity, for dignity together. So the for, the us, for something is something which is more difficult to get, and we have to be all involved in that.
We go to Pepe from Milwaukee. Hello.
Yes. Congratulations for getting into the States.
Thank you.
I just read a book by a Frenchman who claims that the war on terror is really a pan-Arabist movement amongst the Arab-speaking people. The Arab street and the Arab intellectual want to join into one great state of 350 million people, much as Garibaldi united the Italians 150 years ago, Bismarck united the Germans, and now the Arab is 150 years behind. But with modern communication, radio and television, the Arab dialects have become so that Arabs can understand Arabs from Morocco to wherever Arabs speak Arabic. Nasser first coined this pan-Arabism, and Bin Laden is using Islam as a leverage. Nasser was a secularist, and Bin Laden, of course, is not. Anyway, I'll let you comment on this. Thank you.
All right.
You know, this claim is not new. It's just when you want to portray an enemy, just say about them the fact that, you know, they are now trying to have networks, connections, and this is the fifth column, and what they want is the new empire. Look at the state of affairs. Look at the Arab countries. Are they able just to talk to each other? Just look at what is the Arab League. It's just a nightmare. So there is nothing like this which is going to happen. On the other side is that, yes, you have people claiming, like, you know, the spokesperson to Bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, saying, you know, we need to go for this, we need to have a great Ummah, we have to go beyond, borders and to build this new Islamic country with all the countries which were, you know, separated and drawn by the West. But this is a discourse which is not heard by the Muslims and not supported. The great, great, great majority of the Muslims, and this is something which is now a consensus, are not supporting this. They are condemning killing innocent people, and at the same time they are condemning this these calls for something which is completely unrealistic. This is not the way forward. Now, what is quite important for all of us is not to be driven by these discourses that are getting the headlines, even though they are a tiny minority of spokesperson, but they are nurturing the fears around. I think that we don't have to listen to them, but listen now to the mainstream, to the great majority of the Muslims saying, we don't want to go that way. What we want is a peaceful society. We want to build this, and we are not going to create something which is a new empire. This is not the aim. It's just to be, American, or to be European, or to be Egyptian, or to be Syrian. This is the way forward. And if you just remember recently what happened after the football match, the soccer match between Algeria and Egypt, I can tell you it's not going to happen that we'll have a unity in the Arab world even.
I'm sorry, what happened after that soccer match? I guess I missed that. No, please tell me.
People were killed because the Algerian won the, they were winning, and they are going to the World Cup. And in Egypt, they had to play the match in Sudan because it was not possible afterward for security measures, and people were killed. So and it was a shame. It was a shame. So I would say, don't be driven or don't follow this, claims that are nurturing what I call an ideology of fear. We are all scared and frightened, while this is not realistic. This is not what the consensus and what the Muslims want. They just want, as you want in your daily life, to be in a peaceful society where we can speak, when we are free, when there is political freedom. And this is why I'm advocating democratization in the Muslim majority countries.
Right. I should have known about what happened there. I'll have to get more information. What about the issue of, as you know, we say pretty much what we want. We take on, we make fun of people. We point to foibles. Some would consider maybe sacrilegious with our cartoons, with what we say. We protect speech that many people feel is abhorrent. I think a lot of people had problems and didn't fully understand, and I want you to talk more about the issue of free speech and being able to take on anything and how that may collide with blasphemy.
It's a very important question because I think that the first reaction that we got, for example, from living in Muslim majority countries, while quite strange for many Westerners, and saying, what is happening? Why is it so? And I would say that we then had a distorted perception of the reality. Because what happened is with the cartoon issue, I was in Copenhagen just the day it started, and I said to the Muslims that don't react to this. It's a provocation by someone or by a newspaper. Don't react. And I told them, take an intellectual critical distance. It's just to say, we don't like it, but go ahead. And in fact, this is what happened for 3 months. And then this was instrumentalized because the prime minister didn't and refused, in fact, to meet with the ambassadors. So they send a message to the countries of origin, and then they send a group of people of Danish Muslims, and they went with, cartoons. And this was instrumentalized, while the European Muslims were reacting in a very calm way. The proof of that is that when Geert Wilders in the Netherlands was saying, I'm going to launch a movie where I'm going to torn apart a page of the Quran to show that this Quran is like the Mein Kampf of Hitler, the reaction after the movie, he didn't do that, but he was very tough with on Muslims. What happened is that the Dutch Muslims did not react, and he was not happy because he wanted them to react, but he had to thank them for reacting in a very wise way. So it means, in fact, that the Muslims living in the West, they know the rules. They understand what it means to be, to within the legality, within the legal framework, when we are not going as far as, racism or racist statements. you should be free to say what you want, or even to insult in a way which is to ridicule religion. And this is part of where you are. This is part of the culture, and it's legal. So I advocated from the very beginning, as Muslims, we don't need new laws and laws on blasphemies. We don't need this. We need to educate ourselves dealing with this new environment and to be able to say, yes, okay, that's legal. Go ahead if you want. It's silly. I don't like it. You're touching my sensitivity. You should be able to say this and to let the people speak the way they want. And I would say that this is what is happening with Muslims living in the States or in Canada or in Europe. And it's good. This is positive for all of us in the future, in our societies. It's also quite important to say, okay, we have limits when it comes to racism or when it comes to when it comes to blasphemy. But at the end of the day, if we want to live together, we need to communicate and to know what is perceived as an insult by our fellow citizens, because it's good to be driven by legality and laws, and I would say that this is the basis. But sometimes, even in our daily life, there are things that we should not do. In fact, for example, you know, the reaction of some Arabs against or Muslims even against the cartoon, say, well, we are going to insult the Jews and to insult the suffering of the Jews, and I told them, what's that? What are you doing? We are not going that way. It's legal to laugh at the suffering of someone or the suffering of the Jews during the Second World War, but it's silly that we don't do that. If you don't do this in Europe, this is not to be done. This is not morally acceptable. And I would say that in our society, there are things that are legal, but they are silly. And the only way for us to know how to deal with one another is to have more communication, more understanding, and then say what you have to say.
Hmm. We will welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour is considered by Foreign Policy magazine to be one of the 100 top global thinkers of 2009. He has quite a story. He has just returned to Oxford, where he is a professor of contemporary Islamic studies and is considered one of the foremost Islamic scholars in Europe. He just returned from speaking at Cooper Union. He also spoke in Chicago, other places, Detroit, I believe, other places in the United States and Canada. After a six-year ban, he was kept from this country under a provision of the Patriot Act for his ideological views and also for a contribution to a society, to a charity that the United States considered to have terrorist links. The ban was lifted in January of this year, and he's just completed his speeches here in the United States, talking about a number of issues. He has, for quite some time, his scholarship has argued that Muslims can be both fully Western and fully Muslim. He talked a lot this hour about law, language, and loyalty. So we'll take as many phone calls as we can in a moment. 800-486-8655, or the email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Harry from Lake Forest, Illinois. Hi, Harry.
Hi. Yeah, I wondered if your guest would please comment on it, the proposed changes in the law of not being able to wear a burqa in Belgium and in France. What are his thoughts on that?
Yes. I was asked about this, and I went to a hearing at the French Parliament about this few in December. And my position was, you know, as a Muslim scholar, I don't think that the burqa, or what we call the niqab, which is the veil covering the face, I don't think that it's an Islamic prescription. I really think it's not. Now we have some scholars, a minority, a group of scholars saying it is, and they are known as the literalist or the Salafi, and they are promoting this. So when, for example, the president, the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, and people in Belgium are saying it's not a religious prescription, say, look, you can't say this, because even though I disagree, we have people saying it's a religious prescription, and then we have to take it as a religious prescription. Now, how are we going to solve the problem? problem when we have less than 2,000 women wearing it in France, and we don't know how many in Belgium. I would say that I am working from within the Muslim community around, you know, the world, not only in the West, but in many Western countries, and I said it last week when I was in the States, to make it clear that the right Islamic understanding, or for me, the right prescription is the headscarf and not the niqab and not the burqa. So we have to go for something which is pedagogy and education. But to now go to a restrictive way to deal with laws and saying this is banned in the you know, the public sphere and the streets or in schools, you know, banning is not going to solve the problem. And with the mindset that we have within these groups, they would go for something which is about staying at home and being far from the society, so it's counterproductive. So I would say restrictive laws are not changing mentalities. They are just pushing to say, to you know, and showing how we are doing something. And by the way, all these discussions, it's as if we have now in the West, in some Western countries, and especially in Europe, something which is the new visibility of Muslims is problematic. In my country, in Switzerland, we are banning the minarets, and we have only 4 minarets built in this country. So it's as if, once again, the only good Muslim is the invisible Muslim, or the only good Muslim community is the invisible Muslim community. I wouldn't agree with this. So I'm against it from within by saying it's not an Islamist prescription, but I would say that the strategies that we have in some European countries are worrying and really not the right way forward.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about your grandfather. The New Yorker has a piece, which you've probably seen, by George Packer, who was on the panel with you at Cooper Union in Evening with Tariq Ramadan. It is titled. He talks about your grandfather, who was one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he asked you if its origins were characterized by anti-Semitic or totalitarian views. I quote George, "It seemed clear there was a limit to what you would allow yourself to say or think, and he had found it." Would you care to talk more about that?
Yes, we had a discussion, and I was surprised first because it wasn't the topic of our meeting. And then he came by saying, "Oh, your grandfather said this," and he was quoting Paul Berman in his books. I said, "I'm sorry, these quotations are wrong, because I myself wrote something about my grandfather by saying what he said about the Nazi and about fascism was these are very negative distortion of wrong nationalism in the West. This is not the way forward." So he was rejecting Nazis, and there is no one single statement against anti-Semitism in anything that he was written. But he was against the creation of Israel. He was living in the 30s and the 40s. He was facing the Irgun and Stern groups that were terrorist groups and known as terrorist groups. And he was saying, these people, we have to fight against them. Now, the Mufti of Jerusalem, seeing that the British were selling the land to the new groups, was in touch with Hitler, thinking that this was the way to protect him, and this was his strategy. My grandfather never supported Hitler. He supported the Mufti by saying, you have to resist. So this is what I said in our discussion. You have to take all these things into account, because even, you know, people who were creating the state of Israel were in touch with Hitler. They were in touch with the Nazi force when they were trying to build the country. So you have to deal with what was happening on the ground. So my position on this, if I had in front of me one quotation of anyone, my father, grandfather, anyone from my family supporting the Nazi system or supporting fascism, I would denounce that and condemn it. But this is not the case, and I cannot just accept to rewrite the story or rewrite history in a way which is now to put me in a situation when I have to be on the defensive. Okay. I'm not on the defensive. I won't be.
Okay, we have about a minute left, and I'm sorry to take this question with a minute, but what the heck. Munjed from Milwaukee, hello.
Assalamu alaikum, Tariq Ramadan. And I know a minute's probably not going to do justice to the question, but I know you've been critical of U.S. foreign policy, and as a Muslim first and a Palestinian second, something that's very close to me, of course, is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I just wonder, and I know a minute's not going to do justice once again, but I just wonder if you can talk about what the U.S. should do to help resolve the conflict.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds. I'm sorry, Tariq.
No, it's not possible to do
right.
that. But I would like the Obama administration, beyond just showing how disappointed it is with Netanyahu today, is really to go for something which is, and beyond just acknowledging the fact that the Palestinians are suffering, it's just to stop this silent colonization of the Palestinian lands and to come to something which is the true state for the Palestinians with their dignity. And I think that the only country that can do that now, it's the Americans. And just very quickly, I'm not only blaming the states for not doing the job, I'm blaming the Arab countries because they are betraying the Palestinians and they are not supporting enough what should be the central discussion of our time.
Thank you so much for being with us. It was such an interesting hour. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Professor Tariq Ramadan, our guest, professor of contemporary Islamic studies at Oxford University, just returned from a lecture tour of the United States after being banned from this country for 6 years. Thanks to Connor O'Brien for producing this really interesting program, and to Connor as well for on-air production. Tomorrow during this hour, Jim Lehrer will be with us, and Richard Clark will also be with us. Another great hour coming up tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.